Hey everyone, welcome to Refuge Radio. I'm Gaines Taylor, he, him.
I'm Brendan Bell, he, him.
I'm Piper Jones, they, them. This month we've got an excellent conversation with our friend and editor Crystal Jeffers, who uses they, them pronouns and runs a little company called Inclusion Audio for all of your audio editing needs, if any of you are looking to start a podcast too.
So let's get into it.
Hey, I'm glad to be here. It's kind of funny to be with you all because I've heard your voices a lot, but you don't hear from me. I'm the editor behind the podcast, so it's fun to actually be watching the process. And actually, I like seeing Brendan even for the first time, and Piper. We're on a Discord server together. I've talked to Gaines a lot, but it's fun to actually be in a conversation with you all.
Yeah, and we're glad to have you. I mean, this is long overdue at this point. So we're glad that you're going to be able to share a bit of your story today, and we just get to have this conversation with you. So,
well, thank you so much, Crystal. We're so glad to have you on the show in this way. And it is so nice to like finally see you in real life and get to interact a little bit. So yeah, I know, as someone who has definitely listened to every moment of this podcast, you know kind of what our usual questions are, you know kind of where we're going to go. So I'm just going to let you tell us a little bit about where you started in terms of your journey with religion, gender, sexuality. Where did you start? What was all that like for you? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So I grew up in a small town in Northern California in kind of a half Christian household. So my mom did not grow up in a religious environment. She had a conversion experience as a teenager at a camp, and then just kind of left that there for a lot of years. And then kind of went through what a lot of people go through, I think, when they have kids, and she kind of went, oh, what am I going to teach these children? And at that time, she found a church and started going there pretty faithfully, PCUSA, Presbyterian Church, USA Church. And that's where my sister and I were raised. Eventually, she started working there as a children's director. And that's where I spent a lot of my time growing up. That was like a second home. Anyways, had a really good experience there. Spent a lot of summers there. My mom would be like prepping for VBS. You know, we would like literally like live there all summer. We would run around the church. We were probably driving everyone crazy. We'd play foosball in the youth room and all of that. And it was good. I mean, the church was definitely influenced by evangelicalism, but it's a Presbyterian church. So it was more progressive than what you maybe would have seen, you know, like out of a Baptist church or something like that at the time. Like women in leadership was a big deal. My youth pastor in high school was a woman. And it was, you know, it was like, you could tell, I know now in hindsight, she was being treated a little differently than a man would have been treated, but there was no big like controversy about her or whatever. So I'm really grateful that I grew up in kind of a more progressive denomination. I was definitely that like good kid who totally bought in, was on board, started leading worship. When my youth pastor discovered that I could play the guitar, he was like, oh, I was in seventh grade. And he said, oh, wait, you play guitar? I was like, yeah. He's like, can you play this song on the guitar? And I was like, yeah. He's like, okay, you're going to play it tonight at youth group. So I was like, okay, I guess I'm going to play it tonight at youth group. And that was literally how my worship leading career started, which literally did become a career. I worked as a worship leader for a long time up until 2021. So yeah, I mean, I had that whole experience of being at the church a lot. And then at home, I don't want to say that faith was absent at home, but it was interesting to have one parent, you know, who was religious and one parent who wasn't. And I never saw like contention or arguments. Everyone was okay with each other about that. Honestly, I'm kind of grateful. I think it meant that I grew up in a more balanced place. I know a lot of queers or just people that I talk to that have like highly religious parents, you know, like those parents are really like, oh no, you've got to like follow the way of God and our child is a heathen and blah, blah, blah. That kind of thing is just was never a part of my childhood. And I'm super grateful for that. I think part of that is that my mom also didn't grow up in religion. It's been an interesting thing to notice that I and my sister have now had a different experience from from my parents. Like, we grew up in a religious household and we know what that feels like now, a semi-religious household anyway. And my parents didn't have that experience. So now I'm just kind of thinking about like having a conversion experience as a child versus having a conversion experience as an adult, and even where your development is in your brain at that time. Like, those two things I now realize like are different, and not that only one of them is legitimate or whatever, but just things that I've thought about in retrospect.
Yeah.
And then I guess another way that my path kind of deviated from my sister's is I ended up going to a super conservative, I now know, fundamentalist Christian high school.
Mm.
And honestly, it was mostly because of the school's reputation and their sports program. They had a really solid sports program. I was really involved in basketball and soccer and things. And my parents just had no idea that this place was so conservative. Again, like, just no Christian background. They just think, oh, it's a Christian school. Crystal's really serious about her faith. And they put me in this environment where I now know I kind of learned a lot of bullshit.
Yeah.
And growing up in the environment I did, and thankfully I could push back on some of it too. I wasn't totally in a bubble like some of my other peers. I went to really quite liberal public school before transferring in ninth grade, but some of that seeped in for sure, and seeped in during really formative years in adolescence, you know, especially in regards to like gender and sexuality. Like, it was not a great time to be hearing not great messages about people who aren't straight and cis.
Yeah.
I'm curious, Crystal, kind of growing up in this Presbyterian as well as in the family, sort of like a mixed environment of different beliefs, all are welcome, and then transitioning to the school where I'm getting the vibe, the sense that that is not the posture of the school and their belief systems. So tell us a little bit more about how did you process those differences, or what were some of the differences you saw, and what was that experience like for you at that age?
Well, I think the school was in the process of like opening up a little bit while I was there. Like, for example, we had chapel once a week, and my freshman year of high school, girls had to wear skirts on chapel day, which was just really chafing me. Like, I literally had to go buy skirts. I like went and bought the most comfortable ones I could find. I totally hated it. And then they changed that, I think, the next year, and we couldn't wear jeans anymore. But so, you know, they're making like small little strides, but it was a challenge to kind of reconcile these differences. Like, there were certain places where I felt like at school, I was inclined to ask questions and to push it back a little more. Like, I do remember the issue of like homosexuality coming up and just asking that like really, really common question of like, why are we treating this differently than other sins? You know, and then getting the whole classic example of, well, this sin is habitual and other sins aren't. And that makes it worse because it's going to, you know, if it's habitual, then it's going to pull you away from God. You know, it got put in this different category, which is just kind of mental gymnastics. So there was one sense where I'd push back on the school sometimes, especially when I was hearing like homophobic jokes. You know, I mean, it was the 90s and early 2000s. There was tons of "that's gay" going around, you know? And I pushed back on that stuff with my classmates because I was just like, that's okay. Even if we think that is wrong, like, that's just mean. And we shouldn't treat people that way. So there was the one sense where I was pushing back there. But then I see in my youth group too, and even at home, I think I sort of did the same thing there, where I was like a very serious and devout person about my faith. And sometimes I thought, y'all aren't taking this seriously enough over here. Like, I was a worship leader in youth group, and there was a time or two, it was, you know, I mean, it's teenagers, right? And you're like trying to get them to sing praises to God. And some of the teenagers are like, I don't want to do this. Like, maybe I don't even want to be here, or I don't mean what I'm saying, or whatever. But I'm, you know, I like scolded the youth group a few times, like, you guys, this is a really serious time, and this is our time to worship God, you know. And I think all the youth group leaders are like, yeah, Crystal's saying it for us. We don't even have to say it, you know. So I think I felt like I felt it on both ends, but funnily enough, Brendan, I don't think I ever felt like very uncomfortable in that tension. Like the tension was there, but it didn't feel super uncomfortable. But it is interesting for me to think about the fact that I'm literally the only person in my family who had that experience in that space. My older sister, she went to a Catholic school and she had a totally different experience there. And she's the only person in our family who had that experience as well, but definitely a different religious experience and upbringing than my parents had.
I want to say, Crystal, I definitely identify, not in the worship leader sense with you, but in like the, I reached a point, I feel like in my own spiritual development where it's, I hear what you're saying and I feel those things for myself at that age. Like faith was something that became like very serious for me. And I get that where you're like, you look around and you're like, why is no one else taking this as seriously as I feel like I am?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where, I mean, I guess for me too, I did have a couple of different people. We had like it sounds an elite discipleship group at my church called Unusual Soldiers. And so it's like you wanted to be one of the unusual soldiers. And so I guess I hung around those people more. But yeah, it definitely, I think that that's kind of a part too of like youth group culture growing. I don't know if this, and I feel like now I'm putting words in your mouth, but I feel like for me anyways, that was a part of youth group culture growing up.
Oh, totally. Like, I mean, you say that, and I was like, oh yeah, like I was on the leadership team and, you know, just all these ways that like the ante kind of kept like being upped. Mm-hmm. And if there was ever a way to like up the ante, I was like all in on that thing, whether it was leadership or whatever team. And I, you know, for this podcast, I guess I should mention, you know, in the midst of all of this increasing seriousness about my faith, but then kind of entering a more conservative space as well and coming into adolescence was suddenly like, oh, now I'm like interested in women, but oh, well, I'm not supposed to be interested in women. So let's shove that way down deep. And as we all know, suppressing things just makes them worse. Right. So there was a lot of like loneliness during those years and wanting to take my faith super seriously, but then wrestling with that and also feeling like I can't tell a soul. I can't, you know, I'm this leader and this highly regarded person.
Mm-hmm.
I can't admit any struggle. And I'm sure I'm like the only person struggling with this. And, you know, all these scriptures that just say like, oh God, the verse that we take every thought captive and give it to Christ, that just became like my mantra. And it was like the most awful thing. I now that know that like psychologically, that was the worst thing for me to do. Like all of that was doing was compartmentalizing and shoving something away, which only made it more and more prominent and more damaging for me. But in the midst of all of that was this also profound feeling of loneliness, of knowing that I was harboring this secret and not wanting to be found out, and just hoping and praying that that would go away.
Wow. Hi, that really resonates with me as well, because as you heard when you were editing the episode with me, I also was like pretty invested in a very conservative environment, kind of at the same time that I was coming to terms with my own queerness. And a lot of it for me was like, I feel like if I can just throw myself at this faith thing hard enough, if I can just try harder to be this good Christian girl that everyone expects me to be, then I don't have to worry about losing my position, about losing my circle of friends, about losing whatever was like the quintessential important thing to me at the time in favor of just erasing these parts of myself. If I can just bury it, then I don't have to deal with it. And I'm curious how much of that you felt as you were going through this, because you had said that you were in this position for until 2021 in terms of your worship leader gig. I don't know that I formulated that in a coherent thought, but
yeah, I mean, I think I did a lot of compartmentalizing and then you know, I think I was just believing, you know, there was a lot of bad, obviously bad theology, but Mm-hmm. Conversion therapy-ish kind of like, I didn't go to conversion therapy, but there's a lot of that just thinking going on, right? Like, mm-hmm. this can be cured. This is a problem and this can be cured. And honestly, like if you take certain parts of the Bible, like to me, it's like, yeah, that kind of should be the case, right? Like if this is something that's wrong with people, it should be able to be fixed. Lo and behold, it's not something that's wrong with people. But anyway,
yeah.
So I really like believed that for myself and just kind of thought like, if I can get to the root of what is causing this problem, then maybe I can not deal with it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to a pretty prominent Christian university in Southern California. And after I graduated from high school, I was just kind of relieved. I was like, okay, I'm going to get into a new environment. I'm going to meet new people. And this is my chance for me to kind of start over. Maybe I can kind of, yeah, I like all along too, I could tell that there were like these quote unquote, like problems with my female friendships. Like mm-hmm. for some reason I couldn't ever like quite get close enough to someone. And there was kind of stuff going on there that I couldn't understand why that was so difficult for me.
Mm.
So I pack up and I go to Southern California, but I mean, I've got worries in the back of my mind. I'm like, okay, I'm going to have like roommates. I'm like, what if I like have a crush on one of my roommates or something like that? Like that's going through my mind, you know? And this is an evangelical university. And in some ways it felt way more expansive than the fundamentalist high school I'd just come out of. But now I also know like, okay, it's still very evangelical and like pretty narrow in scope compared to the whole of what is out there. But lo and behold, I ended up making a really good friend, but then developing feelings for her. And in that environment, we were both kind of like, this isn't okay. Like we gotta deal with this. We gotta kind of back off. And we did that, you know, like we created boundaries in our friendship. And as I worked through that, I did this series of mental gymnastics, you know, again, with that kind of like conversion therapy line of thinking that it was like, you know what, I just have to find like the quote unquote healthy way of relating to my female friendships. And I keep having this problem with same-sex attraction because I don't know how to relate to women in a healthy way. If I can just find a way to healthfully relate to women, then I'm not going to have this problem anymore. And it's like at the end of my freshman year, I thought I had tied it up in this neat bow. And I think what I had really done was just like created this really hard series of boundaries in this friendship. And, you know, like crushes wane, you know, they come and they wane and they kind of took this natural progression. And, but for me at that moment in time, I thought I'd figured it out. Like I thought, okay, that was done. I have a lot of like empathy and sympathy for people with this struggle. But, you know, that was just like, I kind of chalked it up to being a phase. Because for me, it was infrequent. There was also some kind of attraction to men going on. It was 2002, 2003. There weren't a whole lot of people in my circles talking about being bisexual. Like, I honestly don't even know if I knew that word at that point. So, you know, no one was talking about those things. There was no education about those things. It was like you were gay or you were straight. And being gay was bad and you got made fun of. So I was kind of figuring that all out. And throughout college, I think I just continued to create these series of boundaries in my female friendships. And when I was a senior, I started to develop another really close friendship that I can now see now that there were some crush vibes, but it was like, I would not let myself go there. Yeah. I had just drawn these really hard mental boundaries at that point. So that's kind of where I spent the next decade or more, was just kind of with this sense of like sympathy. And my theology started changing too in my 20s, just got exposed to more writing. The writings of Brian McLaren were really, really influential, just kind of exposing a new way of thought, a new kind of Christian, that whole series that he did a trilogy of books where they're kind of in a conversational fiction style, but working through different theologies and different ways of thinking about faith, you know. Hit some major topics like hell and sexuality and things like that. But, you know, it was starting to change my mind. But in my head, that was about being an ally. It wasn't really about my story. Like I thought that chapter was kind of closed. So, you know, I moved back home. I ended up getting a worship leading job at the church plant of the church that I grew up in. So another PC USA church, but kind of a more conservative one. And as time went on, that conservative stance started to become more and more problematic. And it's like, okay, how long can you stay in a space where you're disagreeing with some things? And I kind of had to ride that line of, okay, if all the people who are allies to the queer community, because it was pretty like even, it felt like there were some really progressive people in this space, and then there were more conservative people there. And it was like kind of riding that balance of, okay, but if all the people who are safe for queer people leave, then where does that leave that this church just with a bunch of people who don't accept them? So I was kind of riding that line for quite a while. And then in my mid-30s, just started having another experience where I realized I'm crushing on a girl right now. And, okay, I haven't felt this in a long time. And it was really interesting as a 35-year-old to meet that thought in a completely different way, just kind of with acceptance and be like, oh, and to just observe it and be like, that's fine. That's not going to upend anything in my life. That thought's not going to kill me. That thought's not going to separate me from God or whatever. But it kind of started a process unfolding of coming to terms with, oh, there's a word for this, and it's called sexual orientation, and yours is not straight. So I kind of got that whole process unrolling of figuring out, yeah, you know, you've been a queer person all along. What ended up being quite a process of unraveling a ton of my life, actually. Mm-hmm.
If I may ask, how do you self-identify, like, in terms of your sexuality and your gender orientation?
Yes. So depending on who's asking, sometimes they just say I'm a queer person, because that's like the most simple answer.
Yep.
But when I first came out, I came out as bi, which I first started coming out in 2019, and that's how I understood things. Mm-hmm. And then as I became part of the queer community and started learning more, you know, just interacting with people, learning more, reading more, being online. At this point in time, I now more identify as a demisexual, panromantic person. So agender. Yeah. So I didn't, you know, it's like you don't know when you start this whole journey. It's like the more you learn, the more you kind of start to figure yourself out. And I don't know if that's where I'm gonna, you know, it's like I've only been on this journey for like 3 years, and I've already kind of changed labels and found things that were more comfortable, that fit more. Maybe they fit at a certain time, and then later on I go, actually, this thing kind of fits more. Or just the acknowledgement that, you know, we grow and change as an individual. As well, I know for some people that's really fixed and obvious, but for me it hasn't been. So
Crystal, do you think you could like do a little bit of some definitions for like our allies and other people learning for like where you are, just so people have a better understanding? Because I know we have a number of like allies who listen to this podcast who are like trying to figure things out and like get an idea of everything.
Absolutely. And I will say, if you would like to know more information about what it means to be asexual or aromantic, you can go back and listen to that episode with Jenna DeWitt. She's incredible. She is such an incredible just advocate and so knowledgeable and so well-spoken. And it was actually her personally that introduced me to these concepts of asexuality and aromanticism and the split attraction model, all those things I'm so grateful for. But so I identify as being on the asexual spectrum, which someone who's asexual experiences either no or much less sexual attraction than the average person. So as much as I can understand about myself right now, as a demisexual, that means you need to have a close emotional bond with someone before experiencing sexual attraction. So that means I've just experienced that very little in my life. And it wasn't until I met Jenna, you start reading about like what sexual attraction is and what it actually feels like. And you're like, these things that I thought were sexual attraction was actually maybe like emotionally feeling close to someone. Like, wait, you mean just thinking some person is cute? Like, isn't the same thing as sexual attraction? Like, that's the experience that a lot of aces have. where it's like, oh, I thought this thing was sexual attraction, but it turns out it's not. I actually don't experience that. So that was really mind-blowing for me to figure that out. And it helped me make a lot more sense of and have a lot more grace with myself for not figuring this out sooner. Because for some people, it's very obvious, right? They're like, I've known that something was about me since I was 5. And then you reach adolescence and you start having those kinds of feelings. And it's like very obvious, you know, like, yeah, it's very obvious to me that I'm only attracted to men or whatever, or I'm only attracted to women, or I'm very clearly attracted to both and all kinds of people. Well, when you don't experience sexual attraction, or you experience it very infrequently, you don't have a very large sample size to draw from in your experience. And that's kind of been my experience, was there was not a large sample size. And I know, like, existing within Christianity,
yeah,
and all those, the rules in that realm, you know, kind of played in that too. But it also made it really, like, really easy for me to be like a great Christian, right? like all these people in college, you know, like in serious relationships, I'm like, what? Really? Is it really that hard to wait? Like, why are you struggling with it so much? Like, well, it turns out I didn't have the same kind of feelings.
Oh, yeah. Well, and it is very interesting to me how much being raised in that Christian environment where of being sheltered under purity culture and not having like a solid guide for what intimacy looks like on like a platonic level, and just treated like any sort of interest is all or nothing. Y'all are gonna get married if you like try to get any sort of emotional connection to someone, can also kind of complicate navigating, okay, is this attraction, or do I just enjoy spending time with this person? Or so, as someone who also kind of identifies on that demisexual level, it's like when we don't know for sure what the benchmark is, it just further complicates these conversations and these journeys of self-identification. So
yeah. And I think that's like the gift that the ACE community has, and the aromantic community, but on that spectrum, has for the world, is like, let's think more closely about like, what does it mean to be attracted to a person, and what are the facets of these things, and analyze like, what do you want in a relationship, and what are the things that are most important to you, and just know that there's no one size fits all thing. Like, a committed relationship doesn't have to only look one way, where obviously there are a lot of religious and conservative religious spaces that are like, a marriage has to look like this with this kind of people doing this kind of thing, you know. And it's like, actually two or more people can have a relationship that looks the way that they want it to look on conditions that they agree to. And there's nothing wrong with that. And there's a lot of beauty in that.
Definitely.
Thank you for sharing all that with us, Crystal. I'm curious for you, in your journey throughout this, what was the turning point, breaking point? Was it a moment, or was it a series of moments? What did that shift towards accepting yourself and wanting to come out look like for you?
Yeah, so I mentioned I'd kind of been having this realization, right, of, oh, I'm kind of crushing on this woman, but well, that's happened to me in the past, and you know, I'm 10 years into a marriage to a man, right, but it's not freaking me out. And I really, Brendan, you mentioned, did you have a moment? I like really truly did have a moment where it hit me like a ton of bricks. And I was reading a book called The Next Right Thing by Emily P. Freeman. I had heard her on a podcast, an Enneagram podcast. Really liked what she had to say. It's a book about decision-making. And I had just read, I read a chapter before I went to bed. And it was about seeing or looking out for the kind of the hidden narratives or the untold stories within your life. And I was kind of ruminating on that as I went to bed. And then, so I have two young children, and one of them screamed in the middle of the night, and it woke me up, and it turned out she was fine. She just screamed while she was having a dream or whatever. But I was wide awake in the middle of the night. And I don't know how or why this thought came into my mind, though. I went, I think I'm bisexual. I took out my phone and I literally Googled definition of bisexual, and it came up, and I just went, yep, that's what I am. That's what I've been this whole time, and proceeded to feel so much relief And of course, also like so much fear and freaking out. Like I barely slept the rest of that night, but I also felt so much peace. Like, yes, of course, this is what it's been the whole time. So then from there, I'm the kind of person that once I know something, I'm kind of all in on it. Like it can take me a long time to make a decision. But then when I have made that decision, like good luck holding me back from following through on it. Mm-hmm. So it took me a grand total of one day to tell one painstaking day to tell a friend, to come out to a friend about this realization, which I was so, so nervous about doing. And then a whole other 24 hours to come out to my spouse, who was not really surprised. And then from there, I started coming out to people who were important to me, family members, close friends. And this was in 2019. So it's the summer of 2019. So I spent a lot of the latter half of 2019 coming out to people in my life, which was wonderful. And obviously it was really exhausting. I mean, there's so much that happens emotionally during that time, but it's also something that I look back on and go, that was so amazing because it led to the most incredible and vulnerable conversations that I think I've ever had with people, like really, really meaningful conversations where it's like, man, I wish we spent more of life kind of on this level of honesty. It was a really hard, but beautiful time. I also, and okay, I've got to say something to my pastor. Our church had hired a new pastor. And it's like, okay, I'm going to come out to him and his wife. This is going to be really hard, but I can't keep this secret in this space. And our church had a non-affirming stance. So I came out to him and his wife, and it was okay. It wasn't like great, but it was okay. And that was February of 2020. And like, 2 weeks later, we were shut down. And honestly, it was a relief. It had become, my physical health was really suffering. My mental health was really suffering. It was becoming really, really challenging for me to exist in a space where I knew I wouldn't be completely accepted. I remember I got this scarf that kind of had, it was pink, but it also had this rainbow on it. And I started wearing it sometimes. And I felt like really proud wearing it, but I was also like, oh God, what if someone puts it together and they figure it out? And I said, I'm like, who's going to figure it out? I'm like married to a man with two kids. Like, why is wearing something with a rainbow on it going to suddenly be like, oh, I think Crystal's not straight after all. And, you know, like, no, but that's like the kind of, that's the closet, right? Like mm-hmm. The closet is so filled with shame and with suffering and with secrecy, and it just does shit to you. So it was kind of becoming more just increasingly unbearable to be in that space. So when the shutdown happened, it was in that corner of my life, it was a huge relief. Like I needed to be out of that space. I still got to make music. I recorded on my computer. We did stuff via YouTube. But it was a relief because I was tanking hard. I was having some pretty severe stomach issues. I was just kind of a mess. So I was really, really grateful for some time just out of that space. And what ended up happening, you know, thankful, I was getting a lot of great support at this time. That was around the time I met Gaines at the LGBTQ plus spiritual conversations group run by Matt Nightingale, who's amazing.
Hi Matt, we love you.
Look Matt Nightingale up on Twitter. And I actually live in the same town as Matt, and he had started this group and it was local. And then when the shutdown happened, he took it online, and the most amazing thing happened was that this group just grew exponentially. And so you had all these Christians from different corners of the country getting to know each other, and just several of us, quite a few of us, you know, just having the same experiences. There were other people like in very similar experiences to me. Like one person who's a gay pastor working in a church where he couldn't be out and was needing to extricate himself slowly from that employment situation. Another person at a conservative Christian university for 20 years. And he also was coming into the process of realizing, I need to leave this space that isn't safe for me. So to walk through those particular circumstances with a group of other people was like such a gift. And there was so much support there. And obviously I was like still going to a shit ton of therapy, walking through that. And I reached a point in the fall of 2020 where I went, I had this realization one day that I was like, why am I letting a group of people, meaning like the pastor and the leadership at my church, why am I letting this group of people determine when and how I can come out? And they were, I mean, that was happening passively, right? Like no one had told, you know, the pastor hadn't said to me, you must tell me before you cut. I mean, it got left kind of weirdly, right? Because I came out to them. I said, and he said, okay, we'll talk about this more in the future. And then the world fell apart, you know? Yeah. So it very much just went on the back burner. No one's talking about it. No one's thinking, well, I'm thinking about it because it's my life. It's very concerning to me. And I hit this point in September where I just went, this is kind of characteristic of an abusive relationship. Like to have someone else making, you know, directly or passively, letting someone else make this huge of a decision for me to keep me in the closet. That's not a healthy relationship. And once I realized that, I was like, well, I don't want to be in the closet anymore. You know, I had some space too, which was nice. I had the opportunity to, I mean, I came out to all of my volunteers via an email. And I did not warn anyone. I did not warn the pastor. I did not warn the leadership. Like I CC'd the pastor and I just did it because I was like, I don't want anyone to stop me. I'm going to do this. And I also had the luxury of not having to see anyone after I did it because we were still not meeting in person. This was before vaccines. Our church was very cautious, thankfully. You know, and I was like, well, this is kind of an interesting buffer and safety zone that I have here during this time to just say what I want to say. Yeah. So I came out and it was weird. Right. We're still not meeting in person. And it actually took a couple of months for church leadership to sit down with me and have a conversation about how we were going to kind of proceed and what was going on. And on the one hand, I appreciated that because that meant no one was jumping to any like really rash, you know, there wasn't like sudden backlash or whatever, you know, no one was being reactive, which was really good and healthy. But it also meant that I had to sit with kind of waiting for what was going to happen for 2 months.
Yeah.
Okay. That was also really not good to my physical and mental health, just waiting for that time. You know, as I came out, I thought, okay, I'm coming out as bi. I'm married to a man. Nothing in my life is changing. Like they can't do anything, right? Like they're not going to like it, but I'm not violating any policy. Like they can't do anything to me. And if they do, then they are subjecting themselves to a lawsuit. We're in California and that's discrimination.
Yeah.
So I kind of thought I was going to be fine. But what ended up happening, of course, is they kind of got me on theology. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a meeting and they asked me a bunch of questions and, you know, they're trying to have it be casual, but of course it was nerve wracking and kind of awful. And it just became clear what a different page we were on.
Yeah.
Like, I had been out for like a year at that point and involved in the queer community. My views had really shifted and it was pretty astounding to be like, oh, okay, whoa, y'all are like way back here in terms of like the very little amount of thought most of you have done about this topic, the very little that you know about queer theology and about the queer community in general. I mean, I got out of that meeting and I sat down in my car and part of this was probably like a coping mechanism as well, but I just started laughing because I like hysterically laughing because I was just like, oh, wow, we are so far apart here. And so like, that was just kind of ridiculous. And on their end, like they thought it went okay. You know, I'm trying to manage my, it was tough. I was trying to manage my answers. I was kind of trying to keep my job at that point. It was the middle of the pandemic. I didn't really want to be unemployed. But eventually their decision basically came down to like, hey, this is our church policy. And if you can't, basically we don't want you to be speaking out about it. They asked me not to advocate for the queer community publicly.
Mm.
And it's like, sorry, no, can't agree to that. It's like, you need to stop your public advocacy for the LGBTQ community. Like, wow, what, what an ask, you know, they think they're asking this small thing, like just stop posting stuff on your Instagram, which by the way, is on a private setting and almost no church people follow me on. But I don't know that they understood what they were asking me to do, but it was.
I'm not going to be complicit in my own oppression, you know?
Yeah, I know, right? I look like the more distance that I have from it, the more I just see how utterly ridiculous that was. So that's how that came to be. And I gave my resignation. And at different times, there were part of me that wished like I had resigned, and I almost wished that I had forced them to fire me. On the other hand, I'm like, I had already been involved in something that was so tumultuous emotionally, and just taking its toll. Like, I have two kids to care for and we're in a relationship to care for. And it's like, what, how much damage do you want to do to yourself before you just say, you know what, like, not all of this can fall on me. You know, like, this community has to do something to change. And I can't carry all the weight and all the burden of this space and trying to change it.
God, I feel that a lot.
So I gave my resignation. They were gracious. They let me stay for another like 4 months because I was like, it's a pandemic. I've got two kids. Mm-hmm. I've got to find a job. So they were gracious in that way, that it also was, you know, it was challenging. We didn't publicly announce my resignation for a couple more months. So that was challenging to, you know, basically have another secret and me showing up and people not knowing, like, I'm out of here. In a few months. So that was how that all went down. In the spring of 2021, I finally said peace out and was sad, you know, a bit sad, but mostly really relieved and just and glad to be moving on to spaces that were going to be more healthy for me.
It's frustrating, the common refrain of people church leadership finding out like their staff or people in the church are queer, and like, we still want you to work here, but we don't want you to talk about who you are or help your fellow queer siblings. Like, but we really like you here, just how we can use you. Like,
exactly. And, it's about what you can do for them. And at that point, it's like, well, that is awful. That feels really bad. Like, of course you want me here because I know that I'm doing a really good job and people like me and I'm contributing and I'm a reason why people are here and I'm a reason why people are staying here. Mm-hmm. You know, of course you don't want to lose that, but guess what? Like, you can't just take part of me and ask me to leave the rest.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's where I still get pretty fired up, because every once in a while I'll hear the latest like homophobic or transphobic bullshit that has come out of where I used to attend, and I'm sitting here like wanting to smash this mug I still have from my internship, because like I wanted so bad to be able to be an influence for change, but to try to like sway their views for the sake of like at the cost of my own like peace, and it's not worth it. Like, I want to do so much more for our community, and at the same time it's like, you got to pick your battles, because otherwise you're just gonna get slaughtered, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
So that makes me wonder, how do you describe your faith these days? Where are you at now that you are a year and a half ish out from where you were?
I kind of laughed when you asked how do you describe your faith these days, because honestly, I don't really know. I mean, I think maybe I'd describe myself as a universalist. I don't think there's any way for me to get beyond some type of label as a Christian, because it's too, I mean, that's just been too much of my life. And I know that has really, really influenced who I am as a person. I have no interest pretty much in institutionalized religion right now. I don't really find God in those spaces. I would say most days I'm not really even actively looking for God, but I know that like goodness and beauty shows up. I really do still hold to so many of the same values of, you know, love and peace and reconciliation. And I don't know I mean, I guess this is what faith is, but I hope that the redemption that's talked about so much in Christianity is true. I really want it to be true. And I try to live like it's true. I don't know if it actually is or not, but I really do love this idea that things in our lives can be redeemed, but that we can grow as people, like that anything that's broken that can be fixed eventually, that nothing's going to be left alone and left to wither and die. Mm-hmm. Or that if it does wither and die, that it can be resurrected. This idea of resurrection still really does resonate with me. And I hope, and I think I believe that it's something that's true, because I've seen it in my life. Like, I've seen beauty come out of pain, and it's not, I definitely don't believe all things happen for a reason. Pain happens to bring us closer to God. I think that's absolute bullshit that's used to manipulate people. But I also do have this belief that eventually, with time and with love and with work, neuroscience, hopefully, things can be made better. And I think that is a divine thing.
Wow. This is something that just was dredged up from some fold in the back of my brain while you were talking just now. I don't know if y'all ever read Garden City by John Mark Comer, but just kind of the idea of John 15, the parable of the sower, or God being the pruner who like takes care of this garden. The idea that like we are planted in specific soil to grow for a time. I think a lot of nurseries for trees, because like little saplings will be planted in pots and grow there for a time, but then eventually they get too big for the pot, and if they're going to continue to grow, they need to get out and plant it in soil where their roots can actually spread, where they can totally like bloom and blossom. And that's what I think about a lot when in terms of like growing in the churches that we were in before and getting too big for our vessels. You know, having to like be transplanted elsewhere in order to do the growing that we need to do. It's not that was lost time in those seasons, and hitting that barrier feels cramped, feels painful, feels like we're too much for the spaces we're in. But once we're out and planted in a place that we can actually fully bloom into who we are, that's, again, it's there's lots of different gardening things that my brain
I love that picture so much, and that's so true, because again, like, I don't want to discount the value of so many faith lessons that I learned growing up. Like, I don't look at all of my time in church and be like, I wish none of that had ever happened, because that's not true. But yeah, I had outgrown the pot and become so restrictive, but I also don't become who I am, I don't think, without that space. Like, there was no way to jump from being a sapling to being where I am now. Like, that vessel had to contain something for a while. I really like that picture, because I have to remind myself not to judge folks who are still within that institution. I mean, there are things that need to be changed. I have critiques and criticisms, and there's work that needs to happen. But that doesn't mean that it's not a valuable and sometimes healthy spiritual space for those people. And I can't judge that. No. I can't judge what's spiritually healthy for another person. Just like they shouldn't be judging what's spiritually healthy for me.
A concept.
So it's where I am right now. And I have to remind myself not to get judgy of people who are still existing in those spaces, which is, easier said than done.
Yeah, because again, we do all have our individual and bespoke growth journeys, and like you were saying about relationships, there's no one set way of how to do things, and not every rose will bloom in concrete, but dandelions say, concrete.
Now, recently, you've had the opportunity over the past year or two, I don't know, COVID time like blends everything together, so I don't even know anymore. Maybe it was last week, like to perform with a bunch of awesome individuals, like, so how did those opportunities come about, and like tell us some of the other stuff you're doing with like Inclusion Audio and your different projects going on.
Yeah, so I don't know, maybe not a bunch of people, but this interesting opportunity came up through COVID. Jennifer Knapp is like my absolute musical hero growing up. I mean, okay, so I was born in 83, so Kansas, her first, you know, major album came out, I think, in 98. So I'm a teenager who's been learning the acoustic guitar for a few years, and that music comes out. Mm-hmm. I'm, you know, steeped in CCM, and her music comes out, and it's like, oh my gosh, this is my music. You know, this isn't like some pretty lady like singing with a gorgeous voice, you know, mm-hmm. don't get me wrong, but this isn't like Jackie Velasquez, you know, singing like some pop ballad. Like, this is someone with soul rocking out on a guitar. Let me learn these songs, right? So she's like my absolute musical idol. Growing up, went to concerts as a teen and all of that. A whole other story, but someone who I met during COVID times, basically as a direct result of all the BS and fallout that happened at my church. She told me that Jennifer Knapp had posted, she was doing online, she was doing Patreon stuff during the pandemic, you know, musicians trying to make it through without being able to tour. And she had hurt her hand, and her wife had this idea to solicit help from her fans to accompany her. I sent in a video for this audition process and got chosen, and she ended up doing this really, really awesome concert where fans, it was like karaoke, basically. Yeah. She did like karaoke to our tracks that we sent into her, these video tracks of us playing along to her songs. And her career is so interesting because there's stuff from the CCM days that was getting chosen. Mm-hmm. There was stuff from her more modern period that was getting chosen. And that was super fun. We got to meet with her a few times because there were, you know, meetings and things to figure out. We met with her afterwards. It just had kind of a shoot the shit kind of Zoom meeting after. I was like, wow, that was really cool. Like, I just got to hang out with Jen online. That was great, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's like, okay, great. That was a great experience. So she was back on the road this fall. One day I got home from work and I checked my email, and there's a email from her manager that I assume got sent to all of us folks who participated in these concerts, basically, and said, Jen's traveling this fall. Here's where she's going. Would you be interested in playing with her live? Mm. Just like looking at my phone, like, oh my gosh. Yeah. Oh my gosh. I cannot believe that. Clear my calendar. Right now. So I was like, yes, I would like to do this on this date. And in October, I totally got to go down, drove down to the Bay Area, and I was there for sound check. I mean, I basically just like hung out with her for a couple hours while she was setting up her stuff and accompanying for her song, a song with her. It's a cool little venue in Berkeley. It was fantastic. And it was so much fun. And it was just so, it was so normal. That's what was so lovely about it. You know, she's asking me like, are you nervous? Do you do stuff like this? I was like, oh, you know, I was like, I was a worship leader for 14 years. She's like, oh, you're fine. And I'm just like a grown-ass adult that doesn't have like hero worship anymore. You know, like, it was just so lovely to feel confident and just be like, Jen's a person, I'm a person. Mm. You know, this person has had a meaningful impact on my life. And I just have this chance to play music with her and have a good time. And what was so beautiful about it too was to see the community of support that chose to drive down and experience that with me. Some really good friends from my old church who have been really supportive, and some new queer friends as well. So to kind of have those different phases of my life meet and support me in that space was just super, super fun and meaningful.
Sounds like such a cool experience. I got really excited when you said Jennifer Knapp, because I have not yet learned to play guitar, but when I decided I was going to, the first thing my mom gave me was a book from Jennifer Knapp, Kansas, Okay, gotta get in it.
Do you want to tell us a bit about Inclusion Audio and your business and what you're working with there?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the kind of hidden gifts of COVID as well was that I basically had to turn our home office into a recording studio. And I had some experience with that. I had to do some music tech in college and whatnot. So I kind of learned how to do that, learned a lot more about mixing just through trial and error. Mm-hmm. Was on Logic Pro X a lot during COVID. And I don't even necessarily know how or why it happened, but I started to go, oh, I know how to do audio editing now. Like, you know, I'm not like a studio level producer or whatever, but podcasts, you know, absolutely, I can do that. And so Inclusion Audio was born with a mission of allowing people to tell stories. And that's like still my hope and my vision for it. Coming into the queer community late, I've just received such a gift from any person who has been vulnerable enough to share their story with me. Mm. And I think and hope that sharing my story with people too has given others a gift. So to be able to do work where you allow people to tell their stories in meaningful ways without the distraction of ums or bad audio quality, to just kind of do the practical work that's necessary to allow people to share has been a really cool thing. So yeah, if you want to check that out, that's inclusionaudio.com is my work website.
Well, I know we so appreciate all of the work that you've done for us over here at Refuge, making us sound as good as possible when I lose a train of thought.
Yes, absolutely. Very much.
Sometimes you catch some hidden gems that no one else will hear, but it is kind of fun.
It's been so much fun just like having you as a friend and working with you these past, 2 years, and just like having you do the podcast, and it's been great. So thank you so much for that and just everything you do and part of the Refuge team and Inclusion team. Yeah.
Yeah, it's been fun.
So our last question, as always, as you know more than many, is like, what would you say to the individual who is in the closet or in an unsafe community? And what like words of advice and encouragement would you give to them?
I was just working on an episode last night and heard you guys ask this question. I went, oh yeah, this one. So I actually, you know, I had a moment to think about it. And the main thing that came to mind was patience. Mm-hmm. I know it's hard, but to just have some patience and some grace with yourself, figuring things out. I'm a late in life queer. It took me a long time to figure things out. And frankly, I think I'll be figuring them out for the rest of my life. So don't be afraid to try on labels and know that they might be labels that you shed later on, that you know, you don't have to put the whole of your identity in a box. To just take the time to get to know yourself and learn from your experiences. That's all going to give you information about who you are and what you want. And none of that is wrong. You know, it doesn't mean you were wrong about who you were. It just means you have more information and you have a more clear picture now. And in the same way, for someone who's in an unaffirming space or has left an unaffirming space, I would just say patience again. Mm. So I'm a year and a half removed from my church job. And I can see clear benchmarks where healing has happened. The first 6 months were really hard. It was really hard when I hit 1 year anniversary. Like that just brought up a lot of memories. And once I passed that, I think things got better. And obviously there's work that goes into that. Like time doesn't heal all wounds, right? Like there's work, there's been community, there's been therapy, there's been support of family and friends. But time helps too. I was actually just back in that space for a memorial service for the first time a couple months ago. And I made some very deliberate choices about how I showed up and when. And obviously it wasn't a church service. It was something different. But I was really okay while I was there. And I was just sort of blown away by that and really just happy about that, to be like, hey, it's a year and a half later and I'm in this space and I'm okay. Like, look how much more sure of myself that I am. Look how I can just own who I am and be in this space and be like, this isn't going to throw me off. You know, like I know that I'm okay. I know who I am and I can be here. It just takes time. And obviously not everyone's going to get to that space at all. People have different tolerances. There are different levels of trauma. You know, you don't have to go back to a space to like conquer it either. I don't want to say that. You don't ever have to go back to that space. But for me, that was an interesting benchmark to just see how healing had taken place. But I had to allow that process to unfold. So if you're discouraged about where you are, or you're just in a bunch of pain, know that it can get better. It's just the process has to unfold. It takes time.
Thank you. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for joining us today. This has been fun. Wonderful. Yeah, it's been great.
It's been awesome.